This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
The announcement has been made. The Liberals dropping the net zero by 2050 climate target. A lot of people expected it, but then there were others who were really surprised. So what is behind this decision and how has it been received? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to have the latest from Canberra for you on this big political story. Also coming up, our long listen for this week is a chat about nuclear war. Now, I know it's really heavy, but it's very interesting. We're going to get into what it means, nuclear war, and how likely it is to happen.
The threat of nuclear war now is great as it has ever been, if not greater, and unfortunately it's growing.
Yeah, we've got an expert on, someone who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 through his work with a group to abolish nuclear weapons. So he knows his stuff. You're going to want to listen to that. First, though.
Hack.
Australia's first treaty with Aboriginal people has just been signed in Victoria.
On Triple J.
Yeah, there have been celebrations, tears, a lot of emotion in Victoria today where Australia's first ever treaty with Aboriginal people was signed today, marking the end of a long road, nearly a decade of consultations, negotiations. And not long after Victoria's truth-telling inquiry, the Yuruk Justice Commission, into the injustices experienced by First Peoples, the United Nations has called Australia's first treaty historic. So just how significant is it? Well, our reporter Ariana Lachente has more from Melbourne.
I'm honoured to welcome you here today to enact change and make history.
On Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung country, Victoria and Australia's first treaty with Aboriginal people was signed.
Premier, Minister and co-chairs, I now invite you to the signing table to sign the statewide treaty.
There was a standing ovation at Government House when the treaty was signed. Ngara Murray, one of the co-chairs of Victoria's First Peoples Assembly, signed the agreement.
Today marks a turning point in our nation's history, a moment where old wounds can begin to heal and new relationships can be built on truth, justice and mutual respect.
She's calling it the treaty era.
And now we begin the next chapter, the treaty era. A powerful new chapter where we walk side by side as equals, strengthening our democracy and shaping a future built on fairness, healing and hope.
And Victoria's Governor Margaret Gardner gave it royal assent, meaning it's officially law.
The first statewide treaty for Victoria, the first in Australia, and the first for the First Peoples in Victoria.
I'm just sitting here contemplating, how long has it been since it took us to get here?
The treaty legislation passed Victoria's Parliament last month, with the state opposition voting against it. But the consultation and negotiation had been going on since 2016, nearly a decade. The First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, an independent and democratically elected body, was established in 2019, with Ruben Berg also co-chair.
We will get from this not just better outcomes for First Peoples, better outcomes for Victoria, better outcomes for Australia.
And the Yuruk Justice Commission, the state's formal truth-telling inquiry into historic and ongoing injustices, wrapped up this year and found evidence of acts of genocide, massacres, cultural destruction, forced child removals and systemic racism. So what will a treaty actually do? Well, a few things. It establishes a First Peoples representative body, known as Gulungwal. It basically makes permanent Victoria's First Peoples Assembly to represent and advocate for Aboriginal people. An accountability body will monitor how effectively the Victorian government is achieving outcomes for First Peoples. And a truth-telling body will continue the work of the Yuruk Justice Commission.
It is a chapter that is founded on truth, guided by respect and carried forward through partnership.
Some countries colonised by the British, like New Zealand and Canada, have already negotiated treaties with Indigenous groups. Now with Australia's first treaty signed in Victoria, the United Nations has weighed in.
We hope this inspires other leaders in Australia and beyond to adopt similar measures to recognise Indigenous peoples.
Treaty processes have started in other states and territories in Australia. In Victoria, there's frustration about the timing. A day after the state government announced its adult time for violent crime policy, which Victoria's Aboriginal Legal Service CEO, Narita Waite, says contradicts the sentiment of treaty.
The treaty will ensure that what happened yesterday doesn't happen again, where our experts are left unconsulted, where we are not acting on best evidence.
There are other risks ahead for the treaty supporters, with the Liberals saying they'd axe it if they win government next year, because they think there are better ways to support Aboriginal Victorians. Trade union leader and advocate Thomas Mayo also adds that the majority no vote in the 2023 Voice referendum profoundly impacted Indigenous communities. But he says today at least there's been a step forwards.
I hope that Australians take notice. I think most Australians do want to see reconciliation. They want to see the past dealt with and reckoned with. And they want to see Indigenous people have full and healthy lives. And this is a first step and we should be celebrating.
Hack on Triple J.
Arianna Lucente reporting there from Melbourne, hearing from you on the text line, on Hack's Instagram as well. Katie says, so good. Look, Victoria has not imploded. Grace has sent a message in. This is what Grace thinks.
I hope it touches all corners of our country. People talk about it around the kitchen table and it sparks a movement in other parts.
A lot of people talking about what they'd like the federal government to do. This is Seamus.
The federal government needs to get this done ASAP. We have to have a truth-telling commission and a treaty.
And then we've got more messages. Someone says, I'm excited as a non-Indigenous person to learn more thanks to this whole process. But Rani says, what will this actually mean for Indigenous people though? So there's some questions coming through as well. We're going to move on.
Hack.
Well, it's crystal clear that the National Party have killed the Liberals today. Barnaby Joyce wanted to kill the National Party and he ended up killing the Liberals too.
Triple J.
Yeah, well, after months of speculation, we finally have an answer on where the Liberal Party stands on net zero, that climate target for 2050. The party today announcing it's going to officially drop the commitment. But opposition leader Susan Lee says that doesn't mean the party does not care about climate change. So how's all this going to work? Well, our political reporter Shalala Madora has been looking into it.
Morning!
Members of the Shadow Cabinet, that is, the people in the Liberal Party who hold the top jobs, were all smiles in public today, despite deep cracks within the party on climate policy.
How are you? It's a wonderful day to be a Liberal. One of the great things about being a Liberal is that we stand up for who we are, what we believe in, and more importantly, we're going to fight for the whole of the country.
They were meeting here in Canberra to finally determine if they'll keep their commitment to net zero or drop it. It came after a marathon meeting yesterday in which members got to speak their minds. Everyone got a go, in alphabetical order. And the people against net zero obviously had the numbers.
Great day for us, I think, to rip this band-aid off, to dump Labor's net zero agenda.
After three more hours of debate again today, we finally got an announcement of the Liberals' new position.
The Liberal Party will remove a net zero target from our policy. And if elected, we will remove the 43% 2030 target and its net zero by 2050 target from the Climate Change Act.
Australia signed up to the target to get net emissions to zero back when Scott Morrison, a Liberal, was Prime Minister. Now the Liberals say they'll set their own shorter-term targets when they're in government next. Opposition leader Susan Lee explains.
Our commitment is that we will reduce emissions on average year on year, and we will do that in line, doing our fair share with comparable countries, and we'll do it as far and as fast as technologies will allow.
They also promised to stay in the Paris Agreement, the international treaty aimed at curbing global emissions levels.
I can 100% guarantee that energy prices, power bills will be lower under us.
What happens now is that three Libs and three Nats work out a shared policy position on climate change that the coalition can all get behind. And then this Sunday, they make that position public.
We would take this policy to the Australian people at the next election.
Shadow Infrastructure Minister Bridget McKenzie, a National, pointed out on Sky News that the Nats are the trendsetters because they dropped net zero first.
And I believe the Labor Party will eventually end up having to follow us on this policy because the alternative can't be achieved.
But if you think this is the end of the conversation, think again.
It's not a compromise that makes me happy. I will still advocate for net zero by 2050.
Liberal Senator Andrew McLaughlin says he doesn't think dropping net zero will win over young voters or voters in the city.
I remain unconvinced that this policy announcement will be sufficiently attractive to those classes of voters.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is making the most of the division.
They're walking away from climate action because they fundamentally do not believe in the science in climate change.
And he's setting the stage to blame the coalition for energy prices going up.
They're also walking away from reliable and affordable energy. Australians cannot afford to keep paying the price of coalition infighting when it comes to climate policy and energy policy.
The Liberal Party's policy, as announced today, is even worse than it was under Scott Morrison, a bloke who brought a lump of coal into the parliament.
Greens climate spokesperson, Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, says the Liberals' policy is basically environmental vandalism.
What an absolute train wreck. And this is a bunch of nutters who want to drive Australia's economy over a cliff and continue to trash our environment.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting there, and a lot of comments coming through on this one. Someone says the Liberals and Nationals are traitors to young people and the future of this country. Another person, the Liberal Party, are cowards and have caved into the demands of the right wing. Another person, what's the point of having commitments if you're just going to decide you don't want to commit to them anymore? Then there are people who are saying, no, I don't agree with net zero. We're going to get into this more tomorrow on The Shake Up. We're going to have a real big discussion about this, and it's going to be very interesting, I would imagine. But we're going to move on now to our long listen of the week, and we're talking about something that we've been hearing a lot about lately.
Hack. Donald Trump revealing America will immediately resume testing nuclear weapons.
President Vladimir Putin just ordered his ministers to prepare for possible new Russian nuclear tests.
But I see them testing. I say, well, if they're going to test, I guess we have to test.
No other country other than North Korea has tested nuclear weapons in this century.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we're hearing a lot about nuclear weapons at the moment. US President Donald Trump asking his administration to resume testing, Russia responding, saying if that happens, it's going to carry out its own tests. It all raises the prospect of nuclear war, a threat that's loomed over the world for decades. And we've obviously seen the devastating impact of nuclear weapons in the past. Think about the obliteration of communities in Japan etched into our memories. Could that happen again? How many nuclear weapons are there in the world? And where do we, Australia, stand in all of this? Well, with me now is someone who has dedicated his life to campaigning for a world free of nuclear weapons. It's Australian Professor Tilman Ruff, who started a group called the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. In 2017, his group, ICAN, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He's with us now. Professor Ruff, thanks for joining us on Hack.
Oh, thanks very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Look, it's a big topic, and it's a dark one as well, and something maybe a lot of people would prefer not to be thinking too much about. But does the potential of nuclear war keep you up at night? Is it something you're constantly thinking about?
Well, I have to say yes. I've made that my life's work, really, because it is really the most acute kind of existential threat we face. Like, if a nuclear war could happen essentially any time, and that would very likely end the kind of world, the habitable planet with this wonderful creation and all this biodiversity and our civilization, you know, in an afternoon.
Yeah, when we think about the biggest threats to humanity, climate change is usually at the top of the list. That's what everyone's attention goes to immediately. But in your view, is nuclear war a bigger threat than the climate crisis at the moment?
Look, I think they're both really big and really urgent. The impacts of the climate crisis will come over time, and there is still potential for significant parts of that to be reversed. But for nuclear war, it would be really abrupt. It would be essentially over within a day or so. Nuclear war has the potential for essentially to do what happened when this huge meteorite hit the Earth 66 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs and three quarters of the other species that lived on Earth. And it should be the most easily preventable of these. The climate crisis is actually harder to deal with. We have to do both of these things. Most people may not think about nuclear war as a climate issue, and it really is, because our climate, the safe and hospitable sort of range of climate that we need, needs to be protected from both uncontrolled heating, but it also needs to be protected from essentially the ice age conditions that would be brought on, you know, within a week or two, if nuclear war happened.
Some really sobering stuff from you there in terms of just how immediate the impact of a nuclear weapon would be. Has there ever been much research into what would happen if one was used against us in Australia, if we had a nuclear weapon drop here?
Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence about what nuclear weapons would do, apart from the bitter experience that you mentioned in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the first time that 80 years ago nuclear weapons were used in war. Those were two, by today's standards, relatively small tactical size nuclear weapons, so respectively 15,000 and 21,000 tons of high explosive equivalent. That's more than 1,000 times bigger just in terms of the explosive power than the largest conventional weapons. So these are gargantuan in terms of just their explosive potential, but of course then they also have the capacity to ignite very widespread fires and to release radioactivity, which spreads indiscriminately on the wind and comes down with the rain. All the evidence suggests that if the nuclear threshold is crossed, that is, if nuclear weapons are used again, it will not be one weapon, that it's very likely to escalate pretty quickly and probably largely uncontrollably. So within hours, it's likely to lead to very large-scale use, like hundreds or thousands of nuclear weapons. And that would have global ramifications of really profound significance. The largest modern nuclear weapons, which are several thousand times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb, were used on a city. You're talking about an area of about 1,600 square kilometres. So in a major Australian city, that would be about 23 kilometres in every direction, would be burned comprehensively over 800 degrees, most of the oxygen consumed, very powerful winds. Essentially nothing could survive within that zone. And those urban fires would lift millions of tons of black sooty smoke up into the atmosphere beyond the lower part of the atmosphere where there's rain and clouds that washes stuff out, right up into the stratosphere and higher, where it would get hot and smoky. It would deplete the ozone that protects us from ultraviolet radiation. The smoke would spread around the globe, would last for about a decade, and would make it colder, darker, and drier underneath that cloud. That would decimate agriculture globally. So in some areas in the northern latitudes, northern Europe, Russia, China, Korea, Japan, Canada, you basically couldn't grow any food anymore at all. And even from a relatively small nuclear war in nuclear terms, so for example, what could happen between an India-Pakistan war, a couple of hundred nuclear weapons targeted on their cities would put somewhere between 10 and 40 million tons of sooty black smoke up into the atmosphere. And that would potentially starve up to 2 billion people or even more just over the next couple of years.
That's really upsetting. It sounds like what you're saying there is it has the potential, nuclear war, to completely wipe out humanity.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
All right, this is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Australian Nobel laureate Professor Tilman Ruff about nuclear weapons, the threat of nuclear war. It's not a pretty discussion. It's pretty dark, actually, but it is also really important. Tilman, how big is the threat of nuclear war right now?
The threat of nuclear war now is widely considered to be as great as it has ever been, if not greater, and unfortunately it's growing. The nuclear-armed states are actually all modernising. So they're not just keeping the weapons they have, they're actually investing in new ones and the delivery systems. Secondly, they're not disarming. The overall numbers are pretty stable in recent years. The business end of those weapons, the ones that are on high alert, so ready to be launched within minutes of a decision, the numbers of those are increasing again.
Who has the most nuclear weapons, do we know?
Russia has the largest arsenal, 5,500 roughly. United States just a tad behind at just under 5,000. So between them, almost 90%. and the rest of them something over 1,000. The most rapidly growing arsenal at the moment is in China, so weapons numbers are going up again. The last treaty constraining Russian and American weapons, the New START treaty, is set to expire in February. So it may well be that, you know, in a couple of months' time, there will be no constraints on the Russian and US nuclear arsenals anymore, and they could effectively double their deployed weapons within about 6 months. We have nuclear-armed states involved in wars, active wars at the moment, particularly in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, associated with nuclear threats, Israel's involvement in multiple wars in the Middle East, also associated with some nuclear threats. Cyber warfare is increasingly common. The involvement of artificial intelligence may introduce uncertainties and potentially make nuclear weapons easier to launch. We're seeing more wars underway now by Red Cross estimates, about 130 armed conflicts around the world. Really, the only major positive development that makes it even more important is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the first treaty that actually bans nuclear weapons.
What is Australia's stance on nuclear weapons, Tilman?
Sure, Australia's got a really checkered history. We export uranium, have done for decades, to most of the nuclear-armed states under safeguards that really can't provide, you know, enduring assurance that that material will stay out of weapons. So Australian governments have claimed to be good guys on disarmament. We've signed every applicable treaty that controls nuclear weapons, except for the ban treaty, a very important exception. But we're really walking two sides of the street. We're trying to have it both ways. Unfortunately, what that does is that it justifies continued possession of nuclear weapons. If it's good enough for Australia, you know, others that face more acute threats, you can't argue that they shouldn't have the same right. And it also makes us complicit in the possible use of nuclear weapons, because we provide facilities. With the increasing enmeshment of Australia in US conventional and military operations, the submarines that are proposed to be based in Fremantle from 2027 might get nuclear weapons. And earlier than that, the B-52 bombers that are planned, so these are big, long-range American bombers that are planned to be on permanent rotation, which effectively means stationed at an Australian airbase, RAAF Tyndall, in the Northern Territory from next year. Some of those carry nuclear weapons, some of them don't. So it's possible that we could, within a year or two, actually be a base of operations for launch of US nuclear weapons. We've never been in that situation before. So Australia is, at the moment, I'd have to say, more part of the problem than the solution.
Does that disappoint you, knowing that Anthony Albanese, before he was elected, was pushing this idea of backing a ban on nuclear weapons, saying it would be a Labor government's priority? He actually held up your Nobel Peace Prize when he was announcing that plan. Is it disappointing to you that he hasn't followed it up with action?
Yes, it is, frankly. They've taken some baby steps in their first term towards constructively engaging with that treaty, stopping voting against it at the United Nations. But they haven't taken the logical next and key step of actually signalling our intention and signing the treaty.
What do you think the impact would be if Australia signed up?
It would be hugely significant globally. Probably the most enduring international legacy of this government. We are strongly stick out like a sore thumb, really, in the region. The Southeast Asian states to our north, all of them, with the exception of Singapore, have joined up to this treaty. All of the independent Pacific nations that can have either done so or will shortly join. Australia is the only country at the moment where the governing political party has a policy to join the banned treaty. So logically, we should be the first of those states to join.
Okay, this is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Professor Tilman Ruff from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. That group was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. So Tilman knows his stuff. On the text line, Otto says, I feel like nuclear weapons act as a deterrent between nations. If everyone has them, no one uses them. But if only a single nation has them, then they control the world. Tilman, that's really interesting, because there are people who say, look at Ukraine. It gave up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees from the US, from Russia, and that hasn't worked out well for them. Can nuclear weapons be an important deterrent?
It's really a profoundly unjust imposition. If you unpack what nuclear deterrence, which is the sort of ostensible justification for nuclear weapons, means it's basically a psychological construct that relies on reliable information, rational leaders who've always got accurate information and make wise decisions and will always decide against nuclear weapons use. Against that, we've got the experience that on multiple occasions, by accident, by misjudgment, by a failure of some computer chip or technical component or somebody sticking the wrong tape in a mainframe computer, nuclear war has almost happened. Nuclear armed states, thinking they were under attack, have begun launch procedures for nuclear weapons. So it can go wrong and go wrong catastrophically at any moment. If you were serious about deterrence, if that was the only reason to have nuclear weapons, you know, just in case, to deter somebody, then firstly, if deterrence failed, you wouldn't use them. Secondly, you might have a couple of weapons, maybe tens. You would have them in an invulnerable platform like a submarine where nobody knows where they are. You would not have them on high alert, and you would be happy to declare that I will never use nuclear weapons first. None of the nuclear armed states have those policies. They use their nuclear weapons every day to threaten and bludgeon other states to be able to conduct aggressive and illegal military interventions like the invasion of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. If Ukraine had nuclear weapons now, then I think it would only have dramatically multiplied the risks of this ongoing military conflict and raised the nuclear stakes.
Tillman, are nuclear weapons big business? Like, are there lots of individuals, companies, corporations who are profiting from the production of nuclear weapons, the retention of nuclear weapons?
Yes, nuclear weapons are really big business. The large weapons companies in particular, but some of them companies that people would be familiar with making other things like Boeing and Airbus making airplanes are also major nuclear weapons producers, Rolls-Royce. But the big defense companies, like the world spends just on modernizing and maintaining nuclear weapons, $100 billion, so roughly 150 billion Australian dollars, fairly serious money every year. Most of that goes to large corporations that make enormous profits. So there is a huge constituency of vested interests. Australian financial institutions, both banks and super funds, invest tens of billions of dollars in the companies that profit from making these god-awful weapons. You know, one very simple thing that everyone can do is to find out whether your bank and super fund does or doesn't.
Tillman, I mean, this has been a really serious chat. I'm not going to lie, it's not been the lightest chat I've ever done. There's been some depressing themes that we've covered over the past few minutes. I'm wondering, as someone who's committed your life to this, and I'm not sure how you do this every day and go out there and talk about these really, really devastating issues, is there any kind of positive spin that you see? Like, can you see a world free of nuclear weapons in the decades ahead?
Absolutely. Dave, this can be done. This should be a relatively simple problem. You know, Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, leaders of the Soviet Union and the United States, back in the mid-1980s, almost agreed in Reykjavik in 1986 to get rid of their nuclear weapons entirely. We could be living in a world free of nuclear weapons now if Reagan's commitment had have been solid and if both their commitments weren't undermined by their minders. We've already eliminated 85% of the weapons that at one time were built. We know how to do this. Treaties that have eliminated whole classes of nuclear weapons or controlled their numbers have been successfully implemented on time. The obstacles are political, not technical. So absolutely this can be done. But these are difficult, horrible things to think about. Like, I can't think of anything more horrible to think about than nuclear weapons, actually. So, yeah, it's really important for me to kind of stay grounded, stay real. But the thing that keeps me going, apart from that this is possible and needs to be done, is that although this is a really terrifying prospect, in that crisis, there's also a profound opportunity. No people who have ever lived on this good earth have ever had the opportunity to do so much good, to protect everything they love and everything they value and all the labor of past generations, all the magnificent fruits of human endeavor and civilization, and to build a safe, secure world for future generations than to save the world now by addressing the climate crisis and getting rid of nuclear weapons. There's no more important or better work for anybody to feel proud about than that.
Really hopeful words to finish on. Professor Tillman Ruff, a Nobel Prize laureate, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Many thanks for having me, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
And yeah, if you do want to hear the full chat with Tilman Ruff, go check out the Hack Pod now. It's up. You can listen to it there. On the text line, someone says, it's absolutely terrifying. Governments with volatile, trigger-happy men have to have them because the other guy has them. All right, that's all for Hack for now. I'll catch you tomorrow. Hack.